Shanghai is the New York of China, and now the Shanghainese say New York is the Shanghai of the United States. The cities have a great deal in common, the busyness, the way everyone's in a hurry, the way people like you, people actually show up for events on a snowy Friday night in Shanghai. They wouldn't let snow get in their way either. And the personalities of the citizens of both cities are very similar. The Shanghainese are easily identified, and often I can tell a Shanghainese person in a room full of Chinese people, because the Shanghainese are extremely confident. They have high self-esteem, even arrogance. They know who they are. They're extremely competent people. You know, they say, introduce the Shanghainese to a new skill or a new fashion, and they will pick it up very easily, down to the last details. New Yorkers are that way too. You know, New Yorkers are trend conscious, and they want to be aware of what's new, and they're adaptable, and they like change. More than that, New Yorkers and Shanghainese are similar in that they're hustlers. They go after what they want. They're ambitious people, and they want to be the leader. They want to be the top in whatever field they're in, especially in business and fashion. So they're go-getters, and they love money. They love to show off. They love that. It's important to them for people to see that they're doing well. A Shanghainese will always be well-dressed. A Shanghainese woman will have her purse matching her shoes. Her hair will be nicely done. The Shanghainese are the most fashionable people in China. And when you go to Shanghai now, you'll see that the men and women are much better dressed than people in this country, even better than in New York. Of course, as you know, New Yorkers are fashionable too. But I think the Shanghainese have, at this point, outdone the New Yorkers. I was just telling Tom that I've just finished a book about old Beijing. And that's got me thinking a lot about the differences between Shanghai and Beijing, which are so stark. There are no two cities which are more different. There's a quality about Beijing, old Beijing, and maybe even now, perhaps, which I admire, which is that the people of Beijing, they love beauty, but they don't feel that they should show it off. It's considered vulgar to show it off. So the most beautiful mansions in Beijing were hidden behind gray, nondescript walls. You would not really know that there was a beautiful courtyard house behind a particular wall unless you knew the residents inside. And to make sure that no one peeped into the gate that led into the walled compound, there would be another kind of spirit wall just behind the gateway, so you'd have to really walk into the courtyard to see what was inside. But the Shanghainese are the opposite. With them, the outside has to be beautiful. Forget about the inside. It's appearances that are important, or most important. And there's one writer about Shanghai who said something which I thought was insightful. She said that when you look at these ornate Western-style mansions, the rich Shanghai entrepreneurs built, the facades are always very impressive, but then you go inside and the rooms are just almost shells. It's almost as if the houses were built to impress people from the outside, but that nothing, there's no beauty inside, no beautiful paintings or furniture, certainly not the kind of courtyard houses with gardens and pavilions that you would find in an old Beijing mansion. One thing which you'll see in the slideshow, but which actually I wouldn't really have time to go into in depth, is how, as I said earlier, Shanghai is. Oh, I'm just going to get the tea, is a city of change and innovation. It's the revolutionary city of China. And again, going back to this contrast between Beijing, Beijing has always been the center of conservatism. It's a place that's not only old-fashioned, but consciously wants to stay in the past. When Shanghai got its first cars and it was starting to enter the jazz era and it was very much a Western city, Beijing, in fact, the rest of China, was really in the Middle Ages. Beijing itself, for all its great beauty, looked as if it belonged in the medieval period. It had that, like most Chinese cities, it had the massive high walls surrounding the city, then more walls and more walls, and there were gates that were shut at night at sunset so that you couldn't get in. But anyway, Shanghai was just so different. So let me get a bit into the history of Shanghai, which you'll see a bit of in the slideshow, but I'm going to get into it now. One reason Shanghai was so different from the other cities in China is that it wasn't really a Chinese city at all. It was a very young city for China. What made Shanghai was the Western presence, more specifically, Western commerce and greed. Before 1839, before Westerners were really allowed north of Canton or Guangzhou, as it's now called, Shanghai was a port, an important commercial port for the North-South China trade. Chinese junks from the north would bring products to Shanghai. They would unload them, and then ships would take them down to Canton in the south. But really, Shanghai was nowhere near as important as Suzhou or Nanjing or Hangzhou. It was simply a trading city. And what really made Shanghai into the city we see today is the fact that Westerners saw Shanghai as an opportunity for them to really market their goods to China. Not just any good. They had a particular product in mind, and that was opium. And actually, opium is the foundation of Shanghai. Without opium, there would be no Shanghai. Without Western greed and the desire to spread commerce and to balance the lopsided tea trade that the English had with China, there would be no opium. You probably all know the story of the Opium War, how the British began selling opium in China because the British had been buying tea from China and more money was spent on tea that was coming in on anything else until the British thought, aha, we can sell the Chinese opium. And there were two men in particular. Their names were William Jardine and Alexander Matheson, who ran Jardine and Matheson, the biggest Western trading company in Canton, in the Far East, and their specialty was opium. And they were essentially smugglers because China had banned the purchase or sale of opium. So Jardine Matheson had these very fast opium clippers that would go up the coast of China and sell opium to a network of Chinese distributors, basically Chinese gangsters, but in the 18th century, you know, who colluded, the Chinese colluded with the foreign opium smugglers for money. But and Jardine and Matheson wanted to have a foothold in central China or along further up the coast in Canton, and earlier Westerners who'd surreptitiously gone up the coast of China saw, they knew that they had visited Shanghai, they'd seen its prosperity, but more important is Shanghai's location. Shanghai sits about two-thirds up the coast of China at the precise point where the Chinese coast bulges furthest east. More than that, the Yangtze River, the Great River, which cuts through about three-quarters of China, its mouth was 14 miles from China, 14 miles from Shanghai, and there's a tributary, the Wangpu, which connects the mouth of the Yangtze with Shanghai. So it was apparent to foreign traders that Shanghai was an ideal city for sending foreign goods, but especially opium, into the heartland of China. So as I described in my book, Jardine and Matheson had started a campaign in Parliament for a war against China. It really was, I don't exaggerate, these two men who were responsible for the Opium War, they provided the British Navy with maps and charts when the British gunboats went up the Chinese coast. Jardine and Matheson's captains were with them to guide the ships, and Jardine and Matheson's opium trading ships followed in the wake of the British Navy to sell opium to the various Chinese ports as they went upwards and conquered each city. Okay, great. That's very nice. As I said, Shanghai does not have a long history for a Chinese city, but there are some vestiges of conventional Chinese architecture in Shanghai. And actually, the Shanghai Old Town probably dates back to about the 13th century. And this is a detail from the Willow Tea House in the old section of Shanghai, which still stands today. It's a great place for tourists. All go to the old section of Shanghai to see the Willow Tea House. And so you see the traditional style gabled roofs, which you would see a lot of in other parts of China, and the windows. And this was a popular place for Chinese gentlemen to gather with their birds in cages and have tea. And so if you go to Shanghai, you can see the Willow Tea House. Next slide, please. All right. So I told you, after the Opium War, I didn't tell you. After the Opium War, after Britain wins, Shanghai and four other cities along the Chinese coast become treaty ports. Treaty ports in China were cities that foreigners, beginning with the British, had won the right to settle in. There were parts of the city that were basically run by foreigners. In Shanghai, there was the British settlement and the French concession. Here we see on the left, Jardine and Matheson's, I believe, yeah, on the left, Jardine and Matheson's Hong, H-O-N-G, a kind of English Chinese word for warehouse or headquarters of a foreign firm. And the architecture is similar to what you see in British India, these veranda style white stucco buildings, and they're built to keep out the sun. So the foreign taipan means a big boss. The foreign bosses would sit on the verandas and have their pink gins in the evening, and there would be young foreign merchants who would join them. And the early foreign colonies were small. In front of these two hongs is what would become the world famous Shanghai Bun, but at that time it was just a towpath. Next slide, please. Well, we see basically the same stretch of the Bund. Well, maybe a block or two further. Okay, this is also the Bund, which is along the waterfront of Shanghai. But now we're in the 1880s. And in the foreground, you have the Central Hotel, the important hotel in the 1880s for foreigners. And to the left, you see Sassoon, the Sassoon house, Sassoon and Sons' Hong. And in between is the beginning of Nanjing Road, which I will get into later. This was a very important intersection of the Shanghai waterfront. Let me tell you a bit about this, about Sassoon and Sons. Among the early traders to settle in Shanghai was a representative of the Sassoon family. The Sassoon family was famous throughout the Far East and Near East. They were a Sephardic Jewish family which had been bankers to the Baghdadi caliphs in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, but anti-Semitism drove them out of Iraq. They went to India, where they started a fortune in cotton and opium. They were British Indian citizens, and Sassoons were among, well, they were competition to Jardine and Matheson. They were actually, at a certain point, the second biggest opium traders in Shanghai. And this was their flagship. Well, by the 1880s, Shanghai was the headquarters for the Sassoons. So this house, this building was their flagship operation. And the Sephardic Jewish community in Shanghai was to grow through the decades and play an important part in the city's history. The Sephardic Jews were colorful and lively and not as sort of dour as the British Taipans. Next slide, please. Okay. Now we're in Shanghai in the 1920s. This is a stereoscopic view of the city. Both sides present essentially the same view, but from different perspectives. And this is the Bund, again, the waterfront. And you see how the city has changed and grown. There are cars and a trolley line. You see these massive Western-style buildings. And in fact, the Bund had become perhaps the best-known symbol of Shanghai to much of the world. When foreigners came to Shanghai in those days, they came by ship, and the first thing they saw was this massive Western-style skyline. And if it weren't for the tiny, tiny figures on the street with Chinese clothes and rickshaws, you would think you were arriving in any European city. And the buildings along the Bund were all owned by foreigners. They were banks and headquarters of shipping companies, newspaper offices, consulates, and This was the part of Shanghai that most of the world that was known as that was the face that Shanghai presented to outsiders. This had become the international settlement. By the 1920s, the British settlement had become what was called the international settlement because it amalgamated with the American, with a small informal American concession. And actually, that was one of three Shanghais. So the international settlement, the first and, well, the best known part of Shanghai, started with the Bund and went in for about 20 miles in. And I could be wrong about that, but this part of Shanghai was run by foreigners. There was a Shanghai City Council, which consisted of the heads of houses of all the big foreign companies. And theoretically, the diplomats for the foreign countries in Beijing governed Shanghai, but on a day-to-day basis, Shanghai was really run by the foreign merchants, by those people who controlled commerce in Shanghai. And the international settlement was a great place to be. It was the most modern place in Asia. It had air conditioning before much of America had air conditioning. It had elevators. It had department stores. It had luxurious clubs and just any luxury you could want. Movies, nightclubs, theaters, tennis courts. All of this could be found in the international settlement. And so this was basically a replication of a Western city in Asia. But then I mentioned there were two other Shanghais. The second Shanghai was the French concession. This was another kind of Western-looking community. It was run by the French, and this was more residential than commercial. And wealthy Chinese and foreigners enjoyed living in the French concession. There they built elegant villas, and there were quiet tree-shaded streets, and many clubs and restaurants, and organized crime, Chinese organized crime, had a foothold in the French concession because the French authorities who ran the concession needed to make, saw an opportunity to make money on the side by working with Chinese organized crime. So there were a lot of casinos, brothels, drug operations in the French concession. I'll get into that a little bit later. The third Shanghai, of course, is the one most people outside of Shanghai never heard of, and that was the biggest. That was Chinese Shanghai. This consisted of the old Chinese city and a huge suburb that had sprouted outside of the international settlement and the foreign concession. Sort of on the fringes of Shanghai. This was, of course, the poorest part of Shanghai. There were no skyscrapers or villas in Chinese Shanghai, just a lot of factories and mud huts. A lot of not very well-built wooden houses. And this was where most of the Chinese lived. The peasants who came to Shanghai to look for factory work, refugees, they all lived in Chinese Shanghai. Next slide. Okay, Nanjing Road. This is Nanjing Road in the 1930s. Nanjing Road was the Fifth Avenue, Broadway, Piccadilly of China. It was China's advertisement to the world of its modernity and sophistication. Nanjing Road was sort of, it was the place where you went when you want, it was the lung and artery of Shanghai. Everything that you could want was on Nanjing Road. It started out as a riding path to go from the, so that foreigners could exercise their horses from the Bund on the way to the racetrack. But the Chinese kind of took it over, and you see, further around this section, just before you get to this part of the photograph, some of the Chinese businesses had their headquarters along this road. But then, and there were many Chinese-owned tea houses. And then as you get towards the end of the road, you see in the background there are these tall kind of belfries and towers. These there are steeples on top of the buildings. These are the towers of the two great department stores, Sincere's and Wing On. To the right, in at the very back of the photo, you would see the steeple to Sincere's, and on the left, right, catty corner from Sincere's was Wing On. I think these are a little. The order's fine. The order's fine. It's my fault. These department stores were among the very first modern department stores in the world, and they were founded by Chinese entrepreneurs. As I said earlier, one of the great things about the Shanghainese is how adaptable they are, and they're go-getting people. They learn very quickly. Actually, it was overseas Chinese who started these department stores, and they were so symbolic of everything that Shanghai was about. The department stores offered Chinese-style goods, but they had the latest in Western fashions and commodities, and the Shanghainese were very proud of these modern department stores. They weren't just stores. They weren't just places where you could go buy things. You could live your entire life in these department stores. There were skating rinks, theaters, restaurants. There were hotels. There were rooftop restaurants. You could watch a Chinese opera in these department stores. You could buy insurance. It was incredible. The Shanghainese, they like to do a lot. They like to cram a lot into one place. Next slide, please. Aha. Okay. Usually, I show this slide before the last slide, but it's my fault. I got them mixed up. You're probably asking, well, who are the people who ran things in Shanghai? Who were these entrepreneurs and taipans who built this great city? Well, we see some of these people in this photo. This would have been taken, I would think, in the 1880s. The Chinese men in the traditional robes are what are called compradors, and you see they're dining with some Westerners. The Westerners are the taipans, the big bosses. Well, the compradors and the taipans made Shanghai work. When foreigners came to China, they couldn't speak the language, they had no contacts, but they wanted to do business, so they relied upon their compradors to do a lot, just about everything. The word comprador means buyer or to a kind of buyer or merchant in Portuguese. Really, the compradors were middlemen. They worked with the foreigner to find distribution outlets in China. They hired the employees who worked on the docks, in the accounting department. The compradors had contacts with Chinese bankers, so they arranged for loans if the foreign taipan was in need of money to start a new project. Compradors were never, ever from the scholarly class. They were never traditionally classically educated Chinese, because anyone from the gentry class would frown upon this kind of work. It was considered really quite beneath an official or scholar to have anything to do with foreigners, certainly not to work with or for them. But the compradors were young, they were enterprising young men whose parents were perhaps merchants or peasants, but they came to Shanghai. They found work they found work with Chinese merchants, and perhaps they were apprentices in small Chinese banks. But they wanted to work for the foreigner. These young, ambitious, Horatio Alger type men saw no problem with learning to speak pidgin English. This was the language that enabled the treaty ports to operate. Chow chow meant food. Chop 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 meant hurry up. And it was a very inelegant language, but it worked for the treaty ports. Anyway, so these compradors were poor boys made good, and they amassed incredible fortunes. They became the richest Chinese on the coast because their positions enabled them to attract, they attracted lots of under-the-table payments, but they were able to work with the foreigner to capitalize ventures. And the compradors and their families became the nouveau riche of China. They were actually the leaders of society, such as it was in the treaty ports, because they were the ones with the power and the money. And in Shanghai, money and power were all that counted. Next slide, please. Okay, now we have a comprador nouveau riche family in front of their English-style villa off of Bubbling Well Road. This family is the Guo family, K-U-O in Mandarin, and in Hong Kong, they're, I think it's the Guok. The name is K-W-O-K, but the Guo family, they owned Sincere's. They started a Sincere's department store, Wing On. The Guo family started Wing On, but in addition to that, they controlled many other kinds of businesses. They had cotton and spinning, weaving mills. They had interests in Chinese-style banks, a lot of different ventures. And as I said, these compradors-type families were social leaders. They set the trends. And because the Guo family also owned Wing On Enterprises, they were always the first to wear the newest style clothes or to show off the newest trends. So here we see them. They're on their great lawn, and this and you see their opulent mansion with the many wings, and the women, they're actually wearing Chinese-style clothes, but they've got foreign shoes on and foreign hairstyles, and the men are wearing the usual white suits that foreigners and the kind of westernized Chinese men wore in the treaty ports. And the men look quite dashing, actually. They've got ties on. And this was how other rich Chinese lived in Shanghai. You had to have the kind of Tudor, you had to have a Western style house. And you had to have the great outspreading lawn. Where the wealthy Chinese liked to live was along in the French Concession or along Bubbling Well Road, which was the extension of Nanjing Road going out towards the suburbs. If you notice, on the right side of the house, there's a kind of another wing attached. Actually, it's very hard to see in this slide, but I always like to mention that even though the Guo family were very trendy and very westernized, still, they had certain attachment to certain old-style Chinese ways. For instance, in the old days, Chinese men, well, rich, wealthy Chinese families had large estates in the countryside, and there would be separate courtyard quarters for each of the man of, for each of the patriarch's concubines or mistresses. Well, so this kind of tradition was replicated in Shanghai in the Guo family and a lot of other rich families when the wealthy Chinese man would have mistresses, usually. All rich Chinese men in Shanghai had mistresses. I don't think it's an overstatement. Usually they kept them in apartments in Shanghai. But in this case, there was a mistress who lived in one of the little wings, the one on the right, extending from the house. Anyway, that's one example of how even the most modernized Chinese, Shanghainese family like to keep some of the older customs. Next slide, please. This is Astor House Hotel, and this was built close to the Suzhou Creek, which is a waterway that intersects with the Wangpu River. It's on the north side of the international settlement. And the Suzhou Creek was a really filthy waterway. A lot of Chinese families, not along the section where this photo was taken, but further west, the poorest Chinese families lived in sampans and along the sort of the edges of the water in very, really appalling conditions. It was said entire families lived and died on the Suzhou Creek. But here you're seeing the posher side of life along the creek. This bridge is a bridge that connected the northern part of the international settlement with the main part. And this Astor House Hotel, which you see, was an institution in Shanghai for the foreigners and I suppose for some of the modernized Chinese. It was built by an American ship captain. And he kept adding to it. He kept adding different sections to it. And he would have a steerage section and a first class section. But this was where, in the 1910s, a foreign Shanghai society gathered for teas. And if you were a wealthy foreigner, you would always stay at the Astor House Hotel. And my favorite story about this hotel was told by Brooke Astor. And her father was an American Navy official when she was a little girl. And so in the early late 1910s, the Astor family went to Shanghai and they stayed at the Astor House Hotel. And Brooke's father took her by the hand, took her down the hallway to their room, and she saw there were these black capped Chinese men and boys wearing immaculate white outfits, lining both sides of the hallway, standing at attention behind each door. Saying attention in front of each door. She said, "Daddy, who are these men?" And he said, "Brooke, these are the boys. They take, whenever you need anything, you open the door and say boy, and they will take care of whatever it is." That made an impression on her. Next slide, please. Well, I've talked about the rich side of Shanghai, and now let's look at the underside. There was plenty of poverty in Shanghai, and you didn't have to look very far to find it. Foreigners and rich Chinese lived a cosseted life, and they really didn't want to know about how the other half survived.
by the 1920s, Shanghai was a huge, huge city. Most of the population were poor Chinese laborers and peasants who had come in from the countryside looking for opportunities to work in the factories, on the docks, or simply for the chance, a chance to survive, because by this time, civil war wrecked China. Warlords controlled the areas outside of Shanghai. There was flood, famine. It was really a desperate place outside of places like Shanghai. But as you can imagine, it was difficult even to survive in Shanghai. There were so many, so many people died in the streets of Shanghai, especially in the winter, that a benevolent association had a cart that went through the city streets every day to pick up the bodies of just the babies that had frozen in the streets at night. This photo that you're looking at was taken by the American journalist Edgar Snow, and it's in the winter because the padded clothing people are wearing, and the huddled figures in the foreground are perhaps children who died in the streets. I would think they had died because of the shocked looks of the people who are observing. Next slide, please. This is a photo taken by Sam Tata. He was a scion of a very rich British Indian family that was in Shanghai. This was taken in the 40s, and very little had changed in Shanghai by that time. This is of a little beggar boy asking two very well-dressed, typically Shanghai needs women for money, and they're looking at him with expressions on their faces that seem to say, "Oh, go away, you filthy little boy." But this was not an uncommon sight in Shanghai. People said, and I'm sure it was true, in fact, I know it was true, that Shanghai was perhaps the cruelest city in the world, certainly the cruelest city in Asia, because wealth and poverty were so starkly next to each other. And during the war, people would see bodies on the street and they would be approached by beggars, and people would say to me, the only way you could really get by was just to ignore it. You had to just turn your eyes away, because otherwise you could not live with yourself. But it was that kind of city. Next slide, please. I mentioned beggars. Well, you saw a beggar in the last photo. This is a photo of the king of the beggars. He actually existed. This was taken about sometime in the 1900s, and is taken outside of Shanghai near the Lohua Pagoda. Well, there were a lot of beggars in Shanghai. Some of them were, I like to think that most of them were genuinely people who had fallen on hard times and couldn't exist without handouts. But a large proportion of the beggars were professionals, and you can find professional beggars all over in China, but they were particularly strong in Shanghai. They were organized. This man, the king of the beggars, he taught beggars the skills of being a beggar, how to whine just so, how to make yourself look pitiable. If there were disputes among beggars, he adjudicated. He also allocated more desirable spots to beggars in Shanghai, so there wouldn't be fights among the various beggars. And there were some beggars who went so far as to maim themselves and even disfigure themselves so that they would appear more desperate to potential donors. And he was quite an influential figure and quite respected. But at a certain point, he had to cede way to more powerful forces. Next slide, please. These more powerful forces were the heads of the criminal secret societies. As I mentioned earlier, the French Concession was a base, the base for a long time, of Chinese organized crime. In a city like Shanghai, where traditional Chinese authority had never been strong and where you didn't have the gentry associations that regulated social relations that you had in older, more established cities, organized crime found that it could really, it was easy to gain control over the city. Here in this photo, you see the three gentlemen who were Shanghai's most famous gangsters. They were quite interesting men, all three of them. On the left, we have Du Yusun. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. Du Yusun was the Al Capone of China. He was a pure criminal mastermind. He had been born in Pudong into a very, very poor family. But he was very clever and organized. And having these, he was a quintessentially Shanghainese figure. He knew how to take advantage of opportunities. As a teenager, he worked on the docks as he was selling. He was a fruit seller, fruit peddler. Then he got involved. Then he was inducted into the Green Gang, the preeminent criminal secret society in Shanghai, and he became a protege of the man on the right, Wang Jinrong was an old-fashioned kind of gangster. He was older than Du Yusun. He had Wang Jinrong's father was a Chinese policeman, and when Wang was a policeman with the French Concession Police Force, and in time he became head of the Chinese detective force for the French Concession, but more importantly, at the same time, he was head of the Green Gang in the French Concession. So you ask, well, how is it possible for this man to head the French police, the Chinese police of the French Concession, at the same time that he's the leading gangster in Shanghai? Well, the answer is that Wang was a kind of comprador of law enforcement. As you probably gathered by now, Shanghai was not the kind of place where law enforcement was such a priority. And because foreigners essentially controlled Shanghai, what mattered was that crimes affecting foreign interests were solved, and that so long as the interests of foreigners were protected, the Chinese crimes could just go on and on. And so the purpose that Huang served is that he regulated crime. Let's say a watch belonging to a foreigner or an important Chinese were stolen. A word to Huang, and that watch would be back in the hands of its owner within 24 hours. On the other hand, if you were an ordinary Chinese, maybe a bribe to the Chinese police might result in your watch being returned, but perhaps not, more likely not. So because the Green Gang, controlled by Huang, derived great profits from its prostitution rackets, drug rackets, gambling rackets, there was plenty of vice to be had in the French Concession and other parts of Shanghai. And it would be rare for a casino to be raided unless they had gotten on Huang's wrong side. So this gives you a sense of the kind of dubious morality that prevailed in Shanghai. Let me get to the gentleman in the middle. This was Zhang Xiaolin. Zhang Xiaolin was the warlord gangster. He actually came from a kind of scholarly family. He was a few notches above his cohorts in terms of his social status, but like a lot of Chinese by this time, he had figured out that the way to really make money was to join hands with the underworld, and he was quite a playboy. He enjoyed the good life, and he was a liaison between the gangsters and the warlords who controlled the areas outside of Shanghai. And he was important to the gangsters, the Green Gang, because opium was the main revenue for the gangsters. And Shanghai was the number one market for opium in China. And by the 1920s and 30s, opium was no longer coming into China from British India because the British taipans had agreed that they would no longer handle opium. So warlords in Yunnan and southwestern China were growing opium, and they had deals with the warlords around Shanghai for opium to be shipped from southwestern China up the Yangtze River, where it would be protected by the soldiers of the warlords. Then at Shanghai, Liu Sun and Wang Jinrong's gangsters would take over, and they would safely accompany the opium shipments into Shanghai. Next slide, please. All right, these are opium hulks. These are dismantled trading ships that were used to store opium. In the days before... Ooh, what happened? I'll keep talking. In the days before opium was outlawed from Shanghai, and the port of Shanghai would see these ghostly white things, these hulks, and inquire what they were. When they were told they held opium, then that gave people a pretty good idea, again, of what Shanghai was about. And missionaries especially hated the opium hoax. It's partly because of the missionaries' efforts that opium was finally officially outlawed, though actually the consumption continued. Next slide. Okay, back to organized crime and amusements and vices and so forth. This is a 1980s shot of the Great World Amusement Center. It was originally built in the mid-teens. It was built by a Chinese medicinal millionaire, intended as an amusement center for the average folk, the Chinese folk of Shanghai. It was intended to offer clean family fun, Chinese operas, games, amusements, foods, a place for the average Chinese worker to go with his family and just relax. Interestingly, note that it has several levels. It looks like an Indian minaret. These are different terraces with different levels of outdoor terraces where you could just keep going. You could eat outside and you could have ice cream, but the architecture is unusual and has to me, a kind of symbolic meaning, and I'll explain that in the next slide. Continue. But I'll keep talking. Wang Jinrong, the Shanghai gangster, bought in quotations the great world from the medicinal millionaire by driving the millionaire out of business in the early 1920s. And Wang Jinrong turned the great world into a center for vice. Every bad thing, it was said, that you could ever want could be found in the great world. And here on One Terrace, we see prostitutes looking for customers. This must have been taken in the 30s because you see the nationalist soldiers with their uniforms. In the lower right-hand corner, you see a prostitute being escorted by her ama, or procurer, and owner, basically, through the great world. They're looking for customers, and it was the ama's job to find customers, to describe the girl's attributes and negotiate with the customer. You see the ama has her arm securely through her girls, through that of the prostitute, because these prostitutes, these poor women, were the virtual slaves of their amas and of the people who controlled the brothels. Organized crime controlled prostitution in Shanghai. A lot of the prostitutes had been kidnapped from their villages, or perhaps they were sold into prostitution by parents who thought their daughter would get a good job in Shanghai. Most of the women, Shanghai had more prostitutes than any city in the world, and there were very few opportunities for women aside from prostitution. But it was very hard to be an independent prostitute. But let me get back to the great worlds. As I said, I love the idea that there were several levels in the great world, and various people who visited the great world would say things like, well, as you ascend to each level of the great world, the vices get worse, and the slits on the skirts of the girls get higher and higher and higher, and people would lose more and more money. There were lots of gambling and lots of ways for you to lose your money in the great world. And it was said that if you managed to get to the top of the great world, to the top level, you probably had lost all your money. And in fact, a lot of people jumped from the top of the great world and committed suicide there because they had lost their last penny. Next slide, please. Shanghai was a pretty decadent city. It was decadent in that, there was a lot. The sexual service industry was huge. Women really were commodities, and this is a whole other subject. And books have been written about this too. But the Shanghai style really managed to combine sort of Western modernity with Chinese tastes in a very unusual way. These are Chinese calendar girls. And here you see that they're looking decadent in a way that they take on poses that are Western, but they're very Chinese as well. And there's on the upper level you see this one Chinese woman posed as Manet's Olympia. So this is interesting. One of the hallmarks of this modern Chinese sensibility is the way they would incorporate aspects of Western culture. But it really was all about commerce, finding ways to make money. And here again, they're finding ways to make money by exploiting women. Continue. Okay, These are Chinese prostitutes from the 1890s. There's a saying that I like. They say that in Shanghai, the world's oldest profession begins at the youngest age. These prostitutes are probably around 13, 14, 15. I wouldn't think any of them are older than 16. Notice there that they've got, some of them have, yeah, they're wearing Chinese clothes, but they have Western accessories. Some of the hats are Western, some of them have gloves. So even as early as the 1890s, the Chinese prostitutes, these are, by the way, high class Chinese prostitutes. And these would be women who would appeal to wealthy merchants or high class Chinese gentry and officials. Even in those days, you know, Shanghai was so, the whole idea, Shanghai already knew that the Shanghainese always, they had already elevated Western style to a certain status. Next. So already, the Shanghainese were already in love with Western culture. Okay, these are white Russian dancers at a nightclub. By the 1920s, with the Jazz Age, Shanghai was the nightclub capital of Asia. This had come about because after the Bolshevik Revolution, there was a flood of white Russian refugees into Shanghai. You know, Shanghai, because it was a treaty port, never asked for visas or passports. It was completely open. Anyone could come there. So these white Russians who could no longer stay in Russia and were too poor to go to America or Europe came to Shanghai. They had a very difficult time. They couldn't speak Chinese. They couldn't speak English. The men were not very good employees because they didn't have that many skills. A lot of them had drinking problems. The men took on jobs as chauffeurs and bodyguards to the rich Chinese. They joined mercenary armies. They joined the foreign police forces. The women, on the other hand, had even fewer opportunities than Chinese women. But enterprising foreigners and Chinese saw that, you know, these women were nice looking. A lot of them were blonde, and they had they just had this kind of personality that the foreign women who were then in Shanghai lacked. So the entrepreneurs started cabarets and nightclubs, and these women were a huge hit, and they broke up lots of marriages among the foreign community. And the arrival of the white Russians really kind of changed, it put a different slant on relations between whites and Chinese in Shanghai, because Chinese saw that they saw white men who were working for Chinese, who were alcoholics, who were sometimes seen begging on the streets because they were in such reduced condition. They saw white women working as prostitutes and dancers, and so the very stuffy foreign Taipan community began complaining. They just felt the presence of the white Russians brought down the prestige of the white man in China, which certainly the Chinese thought was a good thing, but not the whites. Next slide, please. And then after the white Russian women had become, when it was seen how successful the white Russian women were, then came the Chinese dance hall hostesses and bar girls and taxi dancers. Here you see four typical modern Chinese women in the entertainment business. And I'm not sure exactly what work these four women did. I have a feeling they were probably aspiring film stars, because by the 20s and 30s, Shanghai had its own Hollywood, and there were Shanghai-made films, and some of the most famous Chinese actresses had gotten their start as taxi dancers. So every girl, or as dancers, so every girl who got into the entertainment business hoped that she would someday be a film star. And the girls, really, they had this sophisticated style. I mean, you see it here. They had the marceled Western hairdos, and they had the cheongsams, which was unique to China. But the cheongsams were an adaptation of the Manchu bannermen sort of dresses or gowns, but they were given Western touches, and the different kinds of fabrics and the trimmings made them unique. So even though Chinese women at this point were still using their sexuality and looks to advance themselves, the only way they could make money, some people said, well, this is a sign of the modernization of Chinese female. You know, she's broken out of the inner courts, and now she's on her own. Next slide, please. More, just another shot of this new style Chinese woman. I think these must definitely have. I'm sure these are film stars. They're, in fact, probably there's one or two very famous. I think it might be Butterfly Wu, third from the left. I could be wrong. These would definitely be famous Chinese film stars. I apologize for not being able to identify them. Next slide. Up until last month, I could begin the description of this slide by saying the blushing bride on the left is 100 and X years old, and she's still alive and living in Gracie Square in New York. Unfortunately, I now can't say that because the blushing bride is Madame Chiang Kai-shek, and she died last month in New York City. This was taken in 1927. This is her wedding to Chiang Kai-shek on the right. And Madame Chiang Kai-shek was the quintessential Shanghai girl to me. Certainly, she never worked as a taxi dancer, and she wasn't a film star. But she had all those other essential Shanghainese qualities. She was ambitious. She was tough. She had great style. She got what she wanted. She was extremely unusual. Her background, her background was typically Shanghainese, but unusual in its own way. She and her two sisters had been sent to study in America at a very young age by their father, who was a comprador, but who himself had spent time in America. Madame Chiang Kai-shek, or Song Mei-ling as the Chinese knew her, came back to Shanghai with Western education, a Wellesley degree, and she was very modern, and she still spoke Chinese, but her English was much better than her Chinese. She wanted power, and it was her older sister, Song A-ling, who became Madame H.H. Kung, who arranged for Mei-ling to marry Chiang Kai-shek, who in 1927, everyone knew, was going to be the next big power in China. Next slide, please. And Chiang Kai-shek eventually superseded Sun Yat-sen, who we see on the right, to become head of the Kuomintang, or Nationalist Party. On the left, we see Sun Qingling, Madame Sun Yat-sen. Sung Ching Ling was Sung Mei Ling's older sister. What a family, you say. Here are two sisters who each became first ladies of China. I suppose Ma'am Chiang Kai-shek had thought that it might be nice if she... Well, I suppose she was a bit competitive with her older sister, and maybe one reason she wanted to marry Chiang Kai-shek was to show her older sister up... to do her one better. They were very different, the sisters, in terms of their personalities. Madame Sun Yat-sen was a great patriot and a revolutionary. Sun Yat-sen died in 1925, and Madame Sun Yat-sen denounced Chiang Kai-shek when he married her sister because he had betrayed the leftists of China. He had massacred the Chinese left in Shanghai that same year. She aligned herself with the Communist Party. She died, I believe, 1980 or 81. She was a vice president of the Chinese Communist Party. Greatly respected by Mao and Zhou Enlai and the Chinese people, but a very kind of idealistic person, as opposed to Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who was pretty selfish. That's in my book. Next story. Next slide. Okay, now I'm quickly moving on to architecture. This is Cathay Mansions, which was built in the 1920s in Shanghai's French Concession. Architecturally, Shanghai was unique because it had all this Western architecture, and it was really a city that was always ahead of its time. By the 1920s, the rich Chinese and wealthy foreigners were tired of their huge mansions and platoons of servants out on Bubbling Well Road and in the suburbs. So they were moving back into the city because it was, after all, the 20s and the modern age. And they were moving into these fancy apartment buildings where, like Cathay Mansions, where there was a restaurant on the top floor. You could ring a bell and a servant or a boy would come to your room and take your order and do whatever you wanted. And so this was the chic and sleek city life as epitomized by these kinds of buildings, these kinds of luxurious townhouses. Next slide. This building, Cathay Mansions, and many others were built by Sir Victor Sassoon, who you see here in this slide at the horse races with one of his prize-winning horses. I mentioned the Sassoons earlier. Sir Victor Sassoon was the third generation. He was educated at Eton and Cambridge. He was a real man about town. He controlled a lot of property in Shanghai, and he had built Cathay Mansions. He was responsible for the Art Deco modern face of Shanghai. I compare him to Donald Trump, except he had a great deal more taste. He refashioned Shanghai, and he had a vision of how he wanted modern Shanghai to look. Next slide, please. Let me tell you my favorite anecdote about Sir Victor. I told you he was a great man about town, loved horses. His favorite quip was, there are only two great races in the world, the Derby, or as the English say, the Derby, and the Jews. I told you Sephardic Jews are very great in Shanghai. There are no Jews here except for my friend Harry, so no one's chuckling. Okay, this is the Cathay Hotel, which was the place to be in Shanghai. Sir Victor had built it. It was the first Art Deco building in Shanghai. It stood at the corner of Nanjing Road and the Bund. I compare it often to a Sphinx because I feel it looks like a Sphinx. And in the penthouse, which is just below that pyramid you see at the top, was Sir Victor's penthouse, where he threw many fancy parties and he reigned. Next slide, please. In his penthouse, there was a wraparound. Oh, darn. Okay, I don't have the slide. Maybe that will come up next. There's a slide of his penthouse, which had a wraparound terrace. No, leave it. There's a wraparound terrace so he could see. He had a 360-degree angle view of Shanghai. Okay, now we're going on to the Japanese invasion of Shanghai. These are Japanese soldiers in their special armor arriving in Jiabei, one of the Chinese-controlled parts of Shanghai, in 1937. Because in 1937, the Japanese had made clear their intentions to take over China. They began by taking over parts and then all of Chinese Shanghai. Next slide, please. I move very fast. The international parts of Shanghai had become an island free of Japanese troops. They were safe and secure, but the foreigners there knew it was only a matter of time before the Japanese took over the international settlement and French concession as well. August 14th, 1937 was a day that everyone in Shanghai at that time will remember. It was referred to as Black Saturday because four bombs from airplanes dropped on the most packed parts of Shanghai, killing and wounding hundreds of innocent civilians. It was actually the first civilian air casualty of World War II. These bombs, though, did not come from Japanese planes. They came from Chinese planes. Supposedly, Chinese planes headed for the Japanese ships in the harbor had missed their targets and dropped their bombs on the most populated parts of Shanghai, which included the corner of Nanjing Road and the Bund and the square in front of the Great World. A lot of Chinese believe that Chiang Kai-shek had deliberately dropped these bombs on Shanghai because he wanted the foreigners to get involved in the war. There's still a lot of debate about what exactly happened, but here you see bodies piled up on carts right on Nanjing Road, and that's the beginning of World War II. Next slide, please. Okay, by 1941, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, of course, then the Americans joined the Allies, and then the British were also, before then were at war against the Axis powers, but then officially, that's when the Allies officially joined the Chinese against fighting the Japanese. And so this was the end of the treaty ports because the foreign powers, because the Japanese controlled the treaty ports that were supposedly under foreign jurisdiction. And when the Japanese entered the foreign settlements, they put the foreigners in internment camps, and they also rounded up the Jews who had escaped to Shanghai from Europe after 1937 and put these Jews into separate camps, into a kind of concentration camp, but really they told the Jews of Shanghai who'd arrived after 37 to move into Hongkou, which was north of the Suzhou Creek. It was part of the Japanese concession, but a part of Shanghai that poorer Chinese also occupied. Here you see a photo of some of the Jews in Hongkou standing behind a Japanese named Goya, who was the official Japanese, the Japanese officer in charge of all the Jews. And the Chinese, Goya liked to call himself the King of the Jews. He was a strange, temperamental man who could be quite vicious and ruthless to the Jews. But certainly the Jews in Shanghai were treated much, much, much better than the Jews in Europe. And when the war ended, the Jews of Shanghai felt quite grateful that the Japanese had not given in to German pressure and taken harsher measures with the Jews. But during this period, from 37 on to 1945 when the war ended, Shanghai was really a difficult place to live in. There were food shortages, difficulty in communications, a lot of conspiracies and underground dealings. Next slide, please. So as you see, I'm really rushing through this, but that's fine because we're getting close to the end. At all times of strife, Shanghai became flooded with refugees from the area, from the countryside. Here, you see refugees flooding into Shanghai in 1937, just as the Japanese were taking over the Chinese parts of Shanghai. And they're crossing the bridge between the northern part of the international settlement and going into the international settlement. During these periods, Shanghai would be flooded with refugees and there would be barely room. Well, there would be a huge housing shortage, and this is why there were so many dead bodies in the streets. There were so many people rushing into Shanghai, just for shelter. So this one was taken in 1937. And in the next slide, which you'll see, I believe this one is again of refugees rushing into Shanghai. But this time, it's 1949, and this is after the end of World War II, and just as the civil war between the nationalists and the communists is ending, because by now it's clear the communists are headed for Shanghai. So once again, refugees from throughout the countryside are flooding into Shanghai, because even though Shanghai is no longer a treaty port, the Chinese are thinking, well, we'll be safe from the communists from the communists in Shanghai. So again, you have people flooding into the main streets of Shanghai with all their worldly possessions, with mattresses and blankets and what have you. Next slide, please. And now we're really winding up, and I think this might be the very last slide. Yes, it is. Okay. Well, I'm backtracking a bit, but as most of you, what happened is in May of 1949, the communists do enter Shanghai, and they take it over. It's all very peaceful, and Shanghai does adjust. And in fact, this period is much more peaceful than the period just before the communist entrance. This shot was taken by the French photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson in November of 1948. It's entitled Gold Rush. And at this point, inflation had gotten so out of control that the Chinese, the Shanghainese were desperate for an opportunity to convert their convert their gold, to convert their nearly worthless Chinese yuan to gold bars. So, and they were also very angry at the nationalist government, which had taken really extortionist measures to force ordinary Chinese to hand in their gold bars to the government for these increasingly worthless yuan. Anyway, so one, to appease the public, the government announced that one day that week they would open up the banks, the main bank on the Bund, and allow the citizens to exchange their yuan for gold bars. So the entire 24 hours before the bank was to open, Chinese lined up outside the bank, and near riots broke out when the doors opened. People were crushed and trampled to death. And here, also Henri Cartier-Bresson caught that tumult, and you see that in this slide. And this is where my slideshow ends, and maybe there's time for questions. I'll stay if you want to stay. So that's it, the end.
Thank you.
Yes, young lady.
Where do you see Shanghai headed now?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, you know, it's changing month to month. I haven't been there since 2000. I would say, you know, if you asked me, I would say, well, you know, what's interesting is that it's become since the early 1990s, you know, Shanghai has been transformed, you know, from a sleepy city that was denied funds during the communist era. It was repressed. It was deprived of funds because that's how Mao wanted it. And after Deng Xiaoping decided that it would become a priority for renovation and reconstruction, it became the city. It rediscovered its identity. It's once again the city of capitalism, and the Chinese love Shanghai now because it's a city they can really be proud of. And you know, it's again, there's lots of new architecture. I would say, you know, I would say, as long as this capitalist revolution continues, well, I would say as long as the economy continues to move forward, Shanghai will continue to prosper. But what troubles me is this growing chasm between the poor and the rich, because in Shanghai, you see all the old vices and abuses are back. Corruption in a major way, drugs, just people. The people who are getting rich are getting rich very quickly, and then you have all these people coming in, unemployed laborers coming in looking for opportunities. So it's very hard to say. And I haven't been there since 2000, so I'm as interested as you are. Harry.
Well, it's interesting that you should go through that cycle, because you mentioned the white Russians who have come in there after the Russian Revolution. There was no money, and they were pushed out, and so they went to China. And in Macau, which had been the international city before Shanghai was, now, after communism has gone, a lot of Eastern Russians from Vladivostok have crowded in there.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Your social picture, so I read the book, as you know, is very, very good. But areas have to have a governments. All right, you have your gang leaders and you have your businessmen.
Yeah.
Who collected the taxes? Were there mayors? Was there some kind of government of the Chinese section or of the international section?
A very rudimentary government. You know, as I was saying, it was really, you know, Shanghai was not a traditional city. It was more, this is part of the ethos of Shanghai. Everything was thrown together for businessmen's convenience. So not much thought was ever given in Shanghai to the idea of what would make a workable community, or the interests of the ordinary citizen always was of lowest priority. So even government was superseded to commercial interests. So taxes, yes, in the foreign areas, taxes were collected. In fact, the Chinese looked at the foreign settlements as a model of how
the Chinese parts of Shanghai should be administered. They studied it. And right after the 1912 revolution, there was a very concerted effort to have a Western-style municipal government that would provide a modern sewage system and a democratic form of government, a mayor, a city council. Unfortunately, you know, after after the 1911 revolution just never fulfilled its promise, warlords took over, and you know, whoever had the military power in China just had final say on everything. So the vision of these idealistic kind of, the vision of having a modern Chinese municipality was never really given the chance to be fulfilled until the communists took over. So everything was kind of thrown together and hit or miss. No one ever cared about the welfare of the ordinary Chinese.
It's not like Shenzhen today. It's, you know, the no infrastructure.
Yeah.
But Were there schools of any sort in the Chinese?
Oh, yes. There were schools run by by the missionaries. Shanghai really didn't have, it would not have had traditional style Chinese schools. It would have had Western schools, missionary schools, run by foreigners. And actually, you know, I give the missionaries credit. They were really responsible for a lot of the social reforms that took place in China. And they were the ones who introduced the idea of modern schools to the treaty ports. So, some of the Chinese who accomplished the most for China in the 20th century were people who received missionary education. So these were the progressive people. These were the people who really pushed for change. So actually, it's sad to say, there was very little opportunity for an ordinary Chinese to get a decent education in Shanghai unless she went to a missionary school. Organization, just about, could find a home in Shanghai and propagate its views. And Zhou Enlai was able to go to Shanghai and help organize the Communist Party. The Communist Party was founded in Shanghai. Of course, sometimes the colonial authorities would, when things mattered that threatened the interests of foreigners, they would kind of clamp down. So groups like Koreans who supported the government that had been there before the Japanese, yes, they could safely organize in Shanghai. But I think when the Japanese got power in the 30s, I'm sure they made it impossible for the Korean dissidents to protest. They probably drove them out. But Shanghai was also a gathering place for spies. And there's lots of books about different conspiracies in Shanghai. I mean, Ho Chi Minh went through Shanghai. I mean, it was just a nest of different conspiracies. There were gun runners going in and out. And at one point, I think there were different branches of Korean groups in Shanghai. So you had those who supported the Japanese government, the Japanese occupiers of Korea in Shanghai, versus those who wanted the imperial government restored. And with the White Russians, you had supporters of the Soviet government battling the White Russian dissidents in Shanghai. There was actually once a gunfight outside the Soviet embassy. So it was just this unusual place where so many nationalities, I mean, people from so many different parts of the world were able to do what they wanted. Another question. That's it? Okay, yes.
Isn't there a very big, grand synagogue in Shanghai?
Synagogue?
What is the status now?
Okay. I know that the one that Silas Hardoon funded, that would have been, I think, the most impressive one. That one is no longer there.
There were a couple. There were a couple of synagogues. Yeah, I'm not really up to date on that. It's a good. In fact, I need to find out for my own purposes. But a lot of them have disappeared. I know that there's this kind of new. Well, there's some a resurgence of Jewish, the Jewish presence in Shanghai because of all the foreign, the American Jews who are there doing business, and they've tried to resurrect some of the services at their existing synagogues, and they have their organizations and seders. Yeah, I wonder. I think Beth, you're talking about the Beth Aron Synagogue.
The grand.
Yeah, that was it. I think the French concert, I think that one's gone.
Gone? I thought it was used as a storage house.
Oh, okay, let me. That's a very good question. I have to find out. I know one of the really important ones is now gone. So, yeah, so I'm going to inquire. Yes, in fact, yeah, yes.
I was wondering, what kind of opportunities are there for foreigners to work in Shanghai?
I would think loads. When I was there, I was last there in 2000, just after that Asian, the big business recession. And then at that time, a lot of the foreign companies were cutting back because they'd been hit hard by the downturn. But you know, I think for anyone who has a good idea and finds the market niche, it's a great place for foreigners. I personally would advise any young person to go to Shanghai right now, because that's where the action is. And it's not just foreigners who are interested in business who go to Shanghai, but foreigners who are interested in music and the visual arts. There's just a lot of activity there. I personally don't know of any particular business opportunities, and I don't know which American companies are doing business there, but I would think that if you do a bit of homework and make some contacts, you wouldn't do badly at all. Of course, yes. The other thing is that there are a lot of very talented, well-educated, and ambitious Chinese who are looking for the same jobs you're looking for. And these are Chinese who've been educated here in the United States, the finest universities here, who in the old days would have stayed here and gotten jobs. But now they're actually going back to China. So that's a big change. So you're competing with them, too. But maybe you can get a foothold in an American company here that's opening up a China headquarters. But I know that all the companies that had headquarters in Hong Kong, you know, they've all been, Hong Kong is backwater now. It's all Shanghai, Shanghai.
You mean Shanghai is replacing Hong Kong?
Oh, it has replaced Hong Kong. I think so. It's my personal opinion.
And when southern China, the Pearl River Delta.
That's true. That's still active. Yes, but you know the really sophisticated cosmopolitan people, they're all going to Shanghai. And even if you go to Hong Kong these days, don't you feel it, Harry? I mean, you live there. You just feel like somehow the zing has gone out of Hong Kong. The streets are dirtier. All those, you see fewer foreigners. The fancy shops don't seem as fancy.
Well, I think it's simply because of the language. Hong Kong people.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Speak language very well. It's become like the Philippines in certain ways because they speak Cantonese, which isn't any good up in the north. They speak some Mandarin, perhaps from their grandparents. Their English isn't very good. They began studying Japanese when I was leaving for some reason. And so, Hong Kong people never had that real aggressive spirit, which they were told that they had. Singapore had the aggressive spirit.
Well, Hong Kong has always been the poor man's Shanghai. I've always said that even in the days, even before Shanghai changed, I always, you know, Hong Kong is only great because of, well, not only, but one of the reasons Hong Kong became what it was because the big money behind Hong Kong came from the Shanghai refugees who were forced to leave that city in 1949. You know, all the big tycoons in Hong Kong, they're all Shanghai men.
So how yeah. That group, did they go back to Shanghai?
You better believe it. a lot. Yeah, even those old ties have been, those connections are back. Yes. Yeah, so the a lot of money. A lot of the Hong Kong money that's gone back to Shanghai is from the those Shanghainese entrepreneurs. And it's not just in business, but culturally too. At the Shanghai Arts Museum, a lot of the art has been contributed by Shanghainese who are living in Hong Kong or the U.S. And for instance, Shirley Young, Shirley Young is probably still vice president with General Motors, but she's Shanghainese, and for a long time, she is a New Yorker, but now she's representing lots of American companies in Shanghai and the Committee of 100 too. So in every way, you see that. And also, I believe, I have been told that the gangster organizations too are back in Shanghai. Those old ties have been revived as well. And I see no reason why not, because it's really, Shanghai has made this whole 180-degree change.
Are you colluding with the government?
Oh, I would think so. I would think so. I don't see any reason that would stop them from doing it. Yeah, I understand corruption in China is on a bigger scale now than it was in the 30s, and that was pretty bad then. So, yeah, I wish I could give a good answer to your question about what Shanghai's future is. I'm really curious.
It's a huge question.
I guess I need to go back and find out more. I want to thank you all for coming on the snowy night. It's wonderful.